From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The police reacted really in an unprepared and rough way, I have to say. And at the moment, the last news we heard is that Martin is in the hospital in Lausanne, and he got two operations yesterday, and his backbones are fractured, and he got another fracture on the leg and another on his ankle.
A protester at the G8 summit in Switzerland is severely injured when police cut the rope he was hanging from while trying to hang a banner. He dropped 60 feet from a highway bridge. We'll speak with two indie media reporters in Switzerland, and we'll talk about why demonstrators went to France and Switzerland. Privatization of water, AIDS, and the new Partnership for Africa's Development. First, we'll take on the Justice Department's report on immigrants being held at detention facilities in New Jersey and New York, and find out why undercover police shot protesters with rubber bullets in Seattle. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Federal Communications Commission has voted by a majority of one to relax or eliminate decades-old rules governing media consolidation. The changes will unleash a major new wave of consolidation among newspapers, television, and radio companies. The three-decade-old ban on a newspaper buying a television or radio station in the same city is largely gone. The commission also has allowed broadcast networks to buy more stations at the local and national levels. The Republican commissioners, led by Chair Michael Powell, claim the rules were out of date with the rise of cable, satellite TV, and the internet. The two dissident commissioners said the lifting of the rules will stifle free speech. They said as local media operations are absorbed by large corporations, the news will become even more homogenized, and unpopular viewpoints, including those of people of color, will be forced off the airwaves. President George Bush has begun meeting with Arab leaders in Egypt, including the new Palestinian prime minister. Bush has until now avoideda personal role in the Mideast peace process since so many U.S. presidents have failed to broker peace before. U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is also in Egypt for the talks. The BBC and The Guardian report one of the Bush administration's main goals is to secure Arab support for the new Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen. Mazen was installed after Israel and the U.S. refused to deal with Yasser Arafat. Bush is also looking for a strong condemnation of terrorism. The Egyptian foreign minister said Arab leaders will ask Bush for a firm commitment to the implementation of the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace. Arab leaders also want an end to Israeli invasions of Palestinian territory, assassinations, and house demolitions. This morning, Israel began releasing about 100 Palestinian prisoners as a sign of goodwill. But yesterday, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has rejected a request from Bush to declare an end to occupation at tomorrow's summit. The BBC's reporting Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian policeman in northern Gaza. Bush travels to Jordan tomorrow to hold his first summit with the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers. The G8 summit in Evian, France, is coming to a close today. Leaders from the seven richest nations in the world, plus Russia, issued an evasive closing statement, which declared, quote, "Our shared objective is a fully sovereign, stable, and democratic Iraq." Last night at their dinner, the leaders discussed a highly critical document prepared at an alternative summit last week by 1,000 activists. That document included calls for full debt relief for the nation's poorest countries, the enforcement of labor rights, and the creation of international rules to curb pollution. Bush missed that discussion as he'd already left for the Middle East. None of those recommendations made it into the final official draft. document. Outside the luxury hotel overlooking Lake Geneva, where the leaders met, beyond 25,000 police and a steel fence, protests continued overnight. Police used water cannons, rubber bullets, and tear gas against hundreds of demonstrators. The Senate Armed Services Committee has announced it will investigate whether the Bush administration used faulty intelligence information about alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in order to justify an invasion. The investigation is backed by both Republican and Democratic politicians. Virginia Republican John Warner, who heads the committee, said, quote, "The situation is becoming one where the credibility of the administration and Congress is being challenged." The top Democrat on the House of Representatives Government Reform Committee, California Democrat Henry Waxman, wrote a letter to Bush on the issue. He wrote, quote, "To date, you have offered no explanation as to why you and your most senior advisors made repeated allegations based on forged documents." Waxman also noted Bush's doctrine of preemptive strike rests squarely on the ability of the U.S. to gather accurate intelligence and make honest assessments. The BBC reports the inquiry will include public hearings that will be televised live. Leaders of seven key Iraqi political groups held an emergency meeting yesterday on Iraq ruler Paul Bremer III's announcement that the U.S. will appoint an interim advisory council instead of convening a national conference to choose a transitional government. According to the Washington Post, they lashed out at the decision but avoided issuing a joint condemnation because they still hope to change Bremer's mind. Meanwhile, hundreds of former Iraqi soldiers staged a protest in Baghdad demanding pay following the disbanding of the army. The anti-government strikes continue today in Zimbabwe. Opposition officials are vowing to continue despite a violent crackdown by police and troops. Yesterday, soldiers and armored vehicles fired live bullets and tear gas and assaulted protesters. In the capital, Harare, banks and most businesses are closed. And the UN mission in the Congo has confirmed reports of fresh fighting in the mineral-rich Ituri province. This after a spokesperson for an armed faction said yesterday nearly 350 people, mostly civilians, were killed in a weekend massacre in Ituri. The spokesperson also said government troops were involved in the slaughter. UN officials told the AFP they can't confirm civilians were killed, and it's unlikely they will conduct an investigation because they said they don't have the necessary human resources. Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday called for the tripling of the number of peacekeeping troops there.
Freedom, freedom, freedom. Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like I'm a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like I'm a motherless child. Sometimes I feel just like I'm a motherless child. Alone. My own love. Freedom, 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 freedom.
Freedom, Richie Havens, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department report has been released concluding authorities violated the civil rights of hundreds of immigrants detained after September 11th attacks. At a federal prison where over 80 people were held, they said there was a, quote, pattern of physical and verbal abuse. The review by the Office of the Inspector General also found FBI officials made little attempt to distinguish between immigrants with possible ties to terrorism and those who simply had the misfortune to be swept up in the investigation. Without bail, detainees remained in jail for an average of 3 months. They had to wait for weeks until they were allowed to make phone calls and find lawyers. Some were kept for months in cells illuminated 24 hours a day and were escorted in handcuffs, leg irons, and waist chains. In one Brooklyn detention facility, some detainees said guards slammed them into walls and taunted them. We're joined by Rebecca Thornton, who is a fellow at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights and a spokesperson for a group of 20 organizations that met with the Office of the Inspector General when they were preparing their report. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk about the significance of this Justice Department report?
Well, I think it's a very important report because it confirms what advocates have been seeing since September 11th, which is the denial of counsel for detainees, the verbal and physical abuse of detainees in the detention facilities, delays in notifying an individual of the charge, the reason that they're being detained, including many obstacles to obtaining legal counsel.
Now, the facilities that they looked at specifically,
They looked at Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn and the Passaic County Jail in Paterson, New Jersey.
Can you talk about what specifically, what kind of abuse they said they found?
Well, one thing with respect to access to counsel, for example, prison officials instituted a communications blackout policy immediately following September 11th that lasted for several weeks. And this prevented individuals from having access to phones, visitors, even being able to send or receive mail. So that was a very significant finding by the report about denial of access to counsel rights. In addition, as you mentioned, the FBI often arrested and detained individuals on little or no evidence, connecting them to terrorist activity, even though they were characterized as suspected terrorists. And that implicated many consequences, given that when you're designated a suspected terrorist, you may be detained in more severe conditions.
What are the recommendations of the report?
The recommendations of the report include things such as creating more consistent guidelines about what kind of evidence to base a finding of someone being of suspicion in a terrorist investigation, as well as guidelines on how long individuals should be detained without charge, requiring that the government notify individuals in a reasonable period of time, which did not happen.
Mm-hmm. There are no recommendations for criminal prosecution. So they admit, for example, in the Metropolitan Detention Facility in New York, that prisoners were assaulted, were abused, but they're not filing criminal charges against anyone.
That's right. The Inspector General stated that they specifically did not evaluate the legality or illegality of the various policies. But what you can see from the facts that the report lays out, as well as the conclusions made and what the recommendations say, that there certainly is a basis to show that the Justice Department has not acted within the bounds of the law.
The report makes it sound as if the Justice Department only detains something like 700 or so people. But the fact is countless thousands have been detained and continue to be detained.
That's right. There's really a range of policies that the Justice Department has implemented post 9/11. And I think some of those policies have not been reflected in the Inspector General's report. For example, there's a new absconder apprehension initiative that requires individuals to be detained if they have an outstanding deportation order. These detentions were clearly a response to anti-terror measures, but were not included in the report.
We're talking to Rebecca Thornton, fellow at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. The report said that there was a pattern of abuse in New York at the Metropolitan Detention Center, but not in Passaic. What do they mean, pattern of abuse?
Well, I'm actually disappointed that the report does not find the same kinds of patterns of abuse at Passaic that they did at MDC, because what we hear from the communities dealing with the families of detainees is that there are clearly abuses happening at Passaic County Jail. In fact, there have been a number of hunger strikes that have occurred, and I don't think that the Inspector General's report really evaluates those abuses at Passaic in as much detail as they did at MDC.
Does an immigrant in a detention facility have a right to a lawyer?
There's no right to a government-appointed lawyer in the immigration system. However, they do have rights to access to counsel. So they are supposed to be given information about how to contact pro bono representation and be given access to telephones to make those calls. Those are some of the things that did not occur. Lists that were given to detainees of pro bono counsel were out of date and inaccurate, and access to phones was severely limited, and individuals at times were only able to make a call to a lawyer once a week. If they get a busy signal or a voicemail, that counts as their one call per week. So it was severely limited.
Finally, what does this report mean for groups like yours, like the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights? What can you do with it?
Well, I think it's a very important first step towards accountability. You know, the Justice Department has shrouded many of its activities in secrecy, and this is a first, kind of the clearest sense we've had of what's really happening internally in the government. So there are a number of options to pursue as far as encouraging Congress to adopt new legislation that would create better protection for rights, as well as implementing new policy guidelines.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Rebecca Thornton with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights.
Thanks
thank
so
you.
Much.
You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move across the country to Seattle, Washington. Yesterday, protests took place there, undercover police and uniform police shooting rubber bullets at protesters. They were protesting the LEIU, the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, a network of intelligence and law enforcement agencies from Homeland Security to police agencies. We're joined on the phone right now by Mark Taylor Canfield, who's an independent journalist with Pacific affiliate, KBCS, as well as the Indy Media Center in Seattle. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what happened? There's been very little word of these protests.
Well, the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, you know, was formed decades ago, and it took us some time to sort of catch up on what they're about. But there are many cases of abuse where activists have been surveilled by arms of this department, and files shared in instances such as the story you covered in Denver with the police files that they were accumulating on activists. Those files ended up with the LEIU. So we've been trying to educate ourselves up here for a couple months.
And when you say those files ended up, the story that I remember in Denver was that all of these secret police files that were kept on people were given back to the people they were kept on. You're saying that a copy of them also went to the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit?
Yeah, one of the people that spoke up here, her name is Susan Siegel, and she's with the American Friends Service Committee in Denver, for one of the groups that was investigated. And she told us that one of the tactics they tried to use was to send those files to the LEIU. The problem with the LEIU is that it's a semi-private law enforcement network with federal funding, and its objective supposedly is to try to link up all the information networks among law enforcement agencies in the U.S. from Homeland Security down to your local state and local police forces. And Tom Ridge was one of the attendees at this conference, so there was definitely a presence of Homeland Security here. What happened was is that there was a hotel where the conference was being held, and there was a rally at Westlake Center earlier today at 6 p.m. So the marchers went to the hotel and decided to linger, and what they ended up doing was occupying two streets, 4th Avenue and 5th Avenue in downtown Seattle. And after a couple hours, one of the demonstrators had climbed up to the second story window and had burned a flag, and when he came down, there was a very violent arrest by the police where he was literally pulled backwards over the barricade and then shot blank, point-blank range with rubber bullets. So the crowd reacted really angrily, and that started a confrontation where pepper spray was used on the crowd. Then a crowd of several hundred people rushed the barricade in front of the hotel, the Red Lion Inn. And then more pepper spray was used, and then the police started to basically cordon people off and then try to move them down the street back to Westlake Center, where the original rally had begun at 6 o'clock. Using their bicycles and their truncheons, they got people down to 4th Avenue and Union Street and opened up with concussion grenades, flash grenades, rubber bullets, some reports of wooden dowels. So basically they were firing at the crowd, at the backs of the crowd, because the crowd was moving back towards the park. They hadn't stopped. Earlier they had been occupying the intersections.
It looks like people who were trying to capture images of what was happening were particularly hit. An Associated Press photographer doused with pepper spray, a Post Intelligencer photographer sprayed and hit by a rubber bullet. Also, a legal observer was hit and hospitalized?
That was one of the most disturbing scenes to me. Yeah, there was a legal observer, I believe, associated with the National Lawyers Guild, and he was carried away on a stretcher and I believe a back brace, and he looked like he was in a lot of pain, and I did hear him say that he had been shot with something. So there were definitely injuries, even though, as the usual status quo in Seattle is that the local media doesn't report the injuries. But there were injuries. I watched people being taken away by medics, and I talked to medics who had treated dozens of people for pepper spray injuries to their eyes, people who were taking off their clothes, their shirts and things because they were doused in pepper spray and it was burning their skin. And then at least we know at least a dozen people that were arrested, but we're still, of course, we've been up all night trying to figure out where people are, who's in the hospital, what's going on at this point. Tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, people are going to show up at the city council chambers in downtown Seattle to complain to the city council. And then at noon, another protest has been organized by students at Seattle Central Community College on Capitol Hill.
Well, Mark Taylor Canfield, I want to thank you for being with us. Independent journalist reporting to us from Seattle, Washington, about the protest outside the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit Conference, the LAIU Conference. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Switzerland and France, where the G8 have been meeting, and thousands protesting outside. Stay with us. Helter Skelter, the Beatles, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The G8 summit in Evian, France, has come to a close. Leaders from the 7 richest nations in the world, plus Russia, issued an evasive closing statement which declared, quote, our shared objective is a fully sovereign, stable, and democratic Iraq. Outside the hotel overlooking Lake Geneva, where the leaders met, beyond 25,000 police and a steel fence, protests continued overnight. Police used water cannons, rubber bullets, tear gas against hundreds of demonstrators. Over the weekend, police severely injured a 39-year-old British protester, Martin Shaw, when they cut the rope that he was hanging from while trying to hang a banner. He dropped 60 feet feet from the highway bridge and suffered multiple fractures. Police also raided the building some protesters were using as their headquarters. Independent media journalists reported police were dressed in anarchist black bloc gear. This was also a report that came from the anti-corporate globalization protests in Genoa, Italy. Police brutality against protesters was also prevalent at the G8 meeting there. Italian police shot a 23-year-old protester twice in the head, then ran over his body with an armored vehicle. That was in Genoa 2 years ago. Some 500 others were injured there. Well, yesterday we got two indie media reporters on the line with us covering these protests in Switzerland, Jackie Suen and Francesca Bria. Francesca Bria witnessed the police cutting the rope that Martin Shaw had been using to hang the banner. We asked her to describe the incident.
Yeah, so there was an action at about 11 in the morning yesterday on the highway between Lausanne and Geneva, and it was an action organized by around 15 activists from all around the world, and it was a peaceful blockade of the bridge. They put a rope throughout the highway, and at the two ends of the rope, there were two activists hanging, and it was a bridge around 30 meters high. When the police got on the bridge, the first thing they did was panicking, and without listening to the activists, they were explaining the situation and that if they would do anything, you know, roughly, they could kill the two activists hanging off the rope. The police just started panicking, and they removed the activists from the highway, went towards the rope and just cut the rope. And we were there, we were five activists from IMC Italy filming, and we could film the whole images, so we were testimony when the police cut the rope. And immediately after, Martin is this British activist, he fell down the bridge. And luckily, there were the other activists that were taking part of the action could run to the other side and pull the rope, avoiding that also the other young activist that was hanging on the rope could fall from the bridge. So it was really, really peaceful.
Can you explain how they stopped the other person from falling?
Because when they realized that the police cut the other side of the rope, luckily there were some other activists start pulling the rope so that she couldn't fall, and the police was there like without even helping. They were just afraid that the traffic was blocked for half an hour. And also the important thing to say is that they took almost 1 hour just to get ambulances and fire brigades on the spot, while we even thought that Martin could be probably dead because he fell like ten meters high, and so it was really, really the police reacted really in an unprepared and rough way, I have to say. And at the moment, the last news we heard is that Martin is in the hospital in Lausanne, and he got two operations yesterday. And his backbones are fractured, and he got another fracture on the leg and another on his ankle. But he didn't hit his head, and he didn't have any head trauma, so he will feel better soon.
The police are saying they did not know he was hanging from the rope.
Well, the thing is that the action was very well prepared. These were all very experienced activists. Martin itself is a very experienced climber, and the action was really well set up. There was a first line of activists just hanging a banner that made contact with the police, and in front of my face, but also in the footage, you can clearly see that the activists were explaining to the police the situation, and they were explaining that there were two people hanging from the rope, and I even see them looking down. So they could clearly see the setup of the action. But I have to say, like, some of them looked really confused, and they looked that they acted before they even could realize what was the actual situation on the spot. So I can really imagine that some of them didn't realize or really didn't know what they were doing.
What did the banner say?
The banner would say G8 illegal, and another banner would say don't shoot us. Yeah, this was the message of the action. And the action was really well prepared, as I just said, because it is this tactic of peaceful blockading, and actually they could, I mean, it was done very good in a way that it could really block the traffic on the highway, and so that means blocking the delegation going from Lausanne from Geneva to Lausanne and then to go to Evian for about 2 hours, or even more, like 2 or 3 hours. So it was, it could have been a really effective blockade, and just because of this, you know, police reaction, and it became a bad accident.
Francesca, you come from the Italian IMC. How does this compare to Genoa? What has taken place here and the police reaction?
Well, what I have to say is just yesterday, when the police came into the media center, the whole scene looked quite familiar to us. We had a really bad memories coming over because of what happened in the Diaz school in Genoa. And I mean, the general atmosphere is that here there is a lot of conflicts going on, but it's like more diffuse. And I mean, it's not the dimension of Genoa G8. It's clearly a different phase. It's a different stage of this movement, and you know, this is clearly reflected on the types of actions that we are seeing here in Switzerland and France.
Francesca Bria, one of the independent media reporters who police have also been targeting. As we turn now to Jackie Suin, who we reached barricaded in the Indy Media Center yesterday as police surrounded it. She's with Big Noise Tactical Media and the Independent Media Center at the G8 protests.
So I'm here with Indy Media Switzerland in Geneva for the G8 protests, and there have been protests organized in the surrounding areas around Evian, France, which includes Switzerland and a camp by the border called Annemasse. And there have been protests beginning Thursday, protesting against the secret meetings, the illegal meetings of this G8 summit, which the decisions are made without consulting any people who will be affected by these decisions. And so there have been a lot of protests around the environment, around Africa and structural adjustment, a whole myriad of causes that fall into the general rubric of anti-corporate globalization. And the protests began yesterday in Geneva, where I'm based, with road blockades, and the protesters managed, about 2,000, 3,000 protesters managed to block almost all of the bridges in Geneva for a specific period of time. And there were very few confrontations with police at that time. And the idea was kind of symbolic, to block these bridges in order to delay the arrival of the delegations, including the heads of state, to Evian and the G8 summit. And they were successful in doing that. In fact, the delegation in Annemasse blocked the translators from arriving in time. And we also heard just generally there was an official announcement that the start of the meetings had been delayed somewhat. There were also blockades in Lausanne, Annemasse, and there were blockades in the highway from Lausanne to Geneva. And on one of those blockades, as I'm sure you've heard, a 40-year-old man who was in an action which involved him hanging from a bridge was cut down by the police and fell and was seriously injured. He really could have died. The police simply cut the line without any concern for his safety and without listening to any of the warnings by the team of people that were there supporting him. And in Geneva, the protests continued with a large demonstration during the day, which was very peaceful.
Jackie, according to the police, they did not know that he was at the end of the line.
But they were told over and over and over again that this line was the only thing that was holding him there, and to cut it would mean him falling a very large distance. And so they were either well aware or they were, you know, consciously not listening to the many warnings of the people who were there. They did admit later on in the afternoon, after first denying it, that it was them that cut the line, but they first denied that.
Continue with your description.
Continue with what happened in Geneva. So the protests were quite peaceful. It was a large protest. Later on in the evening, starting around 5:30, 6 o'clock, various confrontations began with the police around the area that I'm in now, which is right along the river. and right next to the cultural center where the Indie Media Center is based, called L'Usine, the factory. And the police stayed at quite a distance, but fired tear gas for about 3 hours. And there were various blockades set up along the roads surrounding the cultural center. And then they began to slowly close in on us and close in everybody from the center or push them away. But there still didn't seem to be that many police. And I was actually outside. I was filming. People were sitting down. They thought the situation had calmed down. And then all of a sudden, really out of nowhere, about 20 police officers came through the small police lines that had already been set up around us. But they were dressed as black bloc protesters. They were fully masked. They were wearing, you know, hooded sweatshirts and shorts, all that, looking very much the part of a black bloc protester, except they had these orange police armbands, and they came wielding metal batons up to the front of the door. At that point, myself and one other Indie Media camera person who was there and the many people who were simply gathered in the cafe area came up to the door to prevent them from coming in. They never stated why they were coming in, that they were coming in, what was wrong, and obviously they were disguised in this incredibly curious way to have come in easily without being, by catching us off guard somehow. They pulled back for a moment, and then they charged the door. And at that point, they began beating various people and arresting people. I was beaten myself over the head and in the face. My tooth was cracked in concussion. A man beside me, his skull was cut with a very deep wound. He had to go to hospital. Another man in front of me was taken away in an ambulance right there. He was bloodied on the floor. They never said what they were doing. At that point, we gave them all of our identity cards. And the people who had been in the door, including myself, who had been beaten immediately, were put in handcuffs. And we were taken away to a Geneva police station. And I'll return to what happened to me later, but at that point, the police kept going into the building and controlling, quote-unquote, all the people who were there, taking their identity cards. The Indie Media Center was raided after about half an hour. All the people who were inside had locked the door. The police broke the door down. But what they didn't realize was that we were live streaming the entire process. We were filming their entrance into the Indie Media Center, and this was being broadcast over the Geneva 3 live stream that we've been conducting. And so we were actually able to get that out as it was happening, and we have documentation of these police officers coming in, which is very important because they tried to hide all pictures and prevent the press from capturing them dressed as these black protesters. They didn't damage any equipment inside. They did prevent people from taking photos after an amount of time, and they shut down the stream. But other than that, everybody is okay. My journey continued from the police office, where myself and 10 other people who were arrested at the scene were controlled, and then we were released. But instead of being released in the city, the police officers actually, against Swiss law, drove us about an hour outside the city in the middle of a field, and we had to find our way back. Returned, and the protests were still continuing. There were still some clashes with police around the city. It was very, very tense. And today we've heard that, again, there are clashes in the center of the city, and there's a demonstration heading our way. And so we're actually now barricaded inside the Indie Media Center, no one going in or out.
Can you describe what the police looked like that beat you up?
The police that came in were all masked. They were wearing bandanas or small gas masks over their face. They had hooded sweatshirts, baseball caps. They were quite young. They looked, really like the many people who had been out on the barricades, the black bloc protesters that the media likes to bring out and that we've seen actually in these different demonstrations.
Were they trying to look like that? Were they trying to disguise themselves as that?
And the only thing that identified them was this small orange police band. But in fact, they had been these same people. I recognized them from earlier, from about half an hour earlier. They had been simply walking around dressed like that in the crowd, scoping the situation. And one undercover police officer did actually come into the Indy Media Center without any police identification and just supposedly to take refuge. But in fact, he was a police officer, as we discovered later. They were told as soon as these special units of masked, disguised police officers attacked, some of them went outside to do some crowd control, and they were promptly told by the uniformed police officers to get inside, and the press was prevented from taking pictures of them for the most part at that point. And when they all came out, as it was only the special units that were arresting people and beating people inside, when they came out in sort of a cordon with uniformed police officers on either side, and they actually ran from inside the building to their police vans. They obviously didn't want to be seen. They kept their masks on at all times, didn't want their identities known. And it seems to be routine now for the police to use the pretense of violent protesters to attack independent media centers and to shut them down for periods of time. They did that, as you remember, Amy, in L.A. during the protest there, the Republican convention, and they did it in Seattle, and they did it in Genoa, and they did it here, many other places as well. So the independent media really has become a target, and we need to make a statement against that.
What about the destruction of businesses in the area? The what is described in the mainstream media as the looting, the smashing of windows. Who is doing that?
They were masked protesters, what would be called the Black Bloc. They were people who I didn't recognize from the other demonstrations. It was a small group of people. There were maybe, 50 to 100 people, definitely more like 50 by the end. It was a very small group of people, and the damage is quite limited. I mean, you could drive through Geneva and not know that there had been violent protests, except for the fact that the entire city has been barricaded, really, with these with wood. All the windows have been covered with wood, almost. But the damage was quite limited, and it consisted of breaking windows. There were no buildings burnt or cars burnt or anything like that. It was fairly low level, I would say.
And in terms of the counter-summit activities outside of protests in their streets, have there been alternative forums, summits? What have they focused on? What about the Evian Water Challenge, and what are you hearing about inside? Is there any kind of dialogue inside out?
They seem completely separated, the counter-summit activities and the summit activities. There seems to be very little dialogue, but there have been amazing experiments, I think, not just presentations about alternatives, but an actual attempt to enact these alternatives in the villages that have been set up in Lausanne, Geneva, and Annemasse. These are large campsites that have been set up for people to come. In the case of Annemasse, almost, I'd say, between 5,000 and 10,000 people were staying at that campsite. And within there were media centers, there were workshops and trainings happening every day, there was a radio station, there were various things happening all the time. It was very full of life, and people were really dedicated to the idea of creating an alternative space and not simply being reacting against the events of the summit, but providing real concrete alternatives and trying to see what those would mean in practical terms by living them out.
I think
the independent media centers have been another alternative in terms of the corporate news as well. And what I didn't mention before is that not only was I arrested as a journalist, but there was another journalist arrested at the same time, also from Indy Media, but with official press accreditation hanging around her neck at the time of her arrest.
And the scene right now, you say you're barricaded in. Can you describe what's happening?
The scene outside seems very calm, actually. And we're simply taking these precautions, but you can hear tear gas canisters being shot and rubber bullets being shot at distances away. The train station is about 10 minutes from us, and you can hear explosions from there every so often. It's a demonstration of about 300 people apparently heading this way. But for now, immediately outside of us, things are quite calm. But we have been told that the police have been planning not only to raid the center again, but to try to shut it down completely.
And can you describe again, when you were taken away, where were you taken to?
I was taken to a police station within the city, probably about 5 minutes away from where I was arrested. But then upon my release, as I said, against Swiss law, they drove us without telling us where we were going about 40 minutes into the countryside and left us four women by ourselves at midnight in the middle of a field next to a highway. And we were treated quite roughly at that point, just kind of pushed out of the car with all of our belongings by four police officers.
And how many people would you say have been arrested?
There were 20 people arrested yesterday, 11 of whom were arrested at the Usine. That's the latest reports, but there's varying arrests happening even right now that we're just getting word in. The biggest series of arrests happened yesterday at a campground in Lausanne. One of the villages, the official village, in fact, was surrounded by police, and all of the people inside were detained, about 280 people at the end. And again, it was supposedly simply to control their identities, and they were held in the incredible heat for about 4 or 5 hours. And at the end, most of them were arrested. 40 people were held, and the other 240 were let go.
So you were not officially charged?
We were not charged with anything at all. In fact, in all of the cases, the raid at the Usine and the campground raid in Lausanne, these places where the police have simply come in without any pretext at all, not even providing a reason, the only thing that they've said is that they just want to control people's identity. And they've been taking down people's information, their names, etc. But they're not charging people with anything. And because of that, they're not providing them with lawyers. And they're simply holding them, sometimes brutalizing them, and then letting them go.
Is it true that Evian is completely blocked off, that no protesters can get in, that a train...
There's no way to even approach the city of Evian. It's been completely sealed off. And the latest reports is that even the talks and those activities sealed off to the media as well. So the protesters knew this far in advance, and they tried to get as close as they could to the city. But they were also pushed back. Yesterday, we saw some fairly amazing images from NMS of encounters with that protest with the police, which involved an incredible amount of tear gas as well. But thankfully, no injuries and no arrests.
Is it true that a trainload of people who are going to participate in the Evian water protest were prevented from getting in, and so the protest's been canceled?
Throughout the week, there have been various people prevented or delayed from passing through the borders. But getting through the borders is very difficult. In terms of specific instances, I think the best thing is to check all of the latest updates on the indie media sites and the special coverage, because obviously there are more and more people, and we expect that there'll be more people detained at the borders as people leave the country.
Jackie Suen, indie media filmmaker, often helping out at Democracy Now!, suffered a concussion, her tooth broken, as police attacked her at the Indy Media Center, the G8 Summit. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with two of those who went to raise concerns at the G8 Summit about issues of privatization of water and what happens to Africa when the most wealthy countries in the world meet. Stay with us.
I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Greed is a poison rising in this land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops, its work is never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed's sneaky snare. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Not partial to gender or your sexual desires. All it wants is for you to want to own, to possess, and to buy. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. Has you buying anything?
It's greed. Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we listen to what happened to the protesters, why were they in Geneva area in Switzerland and Evian, France? We're joined right now by Jokey Jehu of the 50 Years is Enough Network, has just flown back to Britain, and Olivier Hodeman with Corporate Europe Observatory, which is based in Amsterdam. Let's start on the issue of the privatization of water. Olivier Hodeman, can you talk about what was called the Evian Water Challenge?
Excuse me, could you repeat the last?
Can you talk about what was called the Evian Water Challenge?
At the G8 summit in Evian, a number of major initiatives were presented by the governments, which were presented as solutions to the drinking water needs of the hundreds of millions of people in the poorest countries of the world who don't have access to clean water. There was this G8 action plan, which was drafted by mainly the French government, which is most of all an ideological document, which really emphasizes very strongly the role of the private sector, of private water companies, and which in a number of specific proposals presents subsidies like development aid money for private water corporations as a solution to deliver clean water to the poorest in the world. So a kind of a subsidizing of privatization.
Jokey Jehu, can you talk about the role of African countries, some of the poorest countries in the world, in the G8 summit?
Well, I think that the G8 leaders who realize that they are an illegitimate body have learned the value of public relations. So last year in Kananaskis, Canada, and this year as well, they've had a number of heads of government from Africa. Last year it was all Africa. This year they had Lula, they had the Chinese premier, they had the prime minister from Malaysia, because they understand that, you know, it doesn't look very good when they meet as the leaders of the 8 most powerful countries, economic and militarily, and decide the fate of the rest of the world. And so we have these African leaders who have come, who came to the to Switzerland and who participated in some of the G8 meetings. But I think that for my African colleagues who were in Geneva and in Annemasse, people are really saying that, what these leaders are doing is playing a role in the selling off of Africa through privatization of resources, including mineral resources, but also of services like water and electricity.
There was an alternative, a counter summit that 1,000 anti-corporate globalization activists attended last week and put together a document that supposedly some of the G8 leaders looked at last night. Can you talk about what that is and what you are calling for?
I'm not familiar with the document, but I think I was at the counter summit. I was on Saturday. There was a debt tribunal, and also at the same venue, which was at the UNIMEO University in Geneva. There were other sessions going on around Middle East issues and other kinds of issues related to globalization. And then the day before, there had been a whole day long, again, of teachings and symposium addressing a whole range of issues. And what is very clear to people is that the leaders, I mean, we've known this, that the leaders can't be trusted and that they will come together and make the deal. At the time of the war in Iraq, there was some people thought that perhaps, you know, Chirac and Schroeder from Germany had emerged as the friends of people fighting for global justice. But what is clear is that at the end of the day, these leaders will come together. They will kiss and make up to some extent. It wasn't as a huge success as they had hoped, but they will make up and continue with the agenda of corporate globalization. And really, you know, the fight now is about the divvying up of the spoils of the war in Iraq and looking around the world at where else they can get something to divide up amongst themselves. And for the people at the teachings, it's again both analysis, but also talking about alternatives. You know, we've done the analysis. The figures are there; they speak for themselves, and it doesn't look like they're paying any attention, or if they're paying attention, it's taking too long for their response. And you know, I say that I thought of it that where we need to go, we need to think very creatively and really step out and step up front. In a strategy, kind of like the kind of strategy that we saw in the late days of the apartheid regime, that really at one point it was very clear that all the strategies we had been applying were not working, that we needed something different that would really break open this stranglehold of apartheid. And I think that that's where we are in terms of the control of multinational corporations, the role of the G7, G8 countries, the role of the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization, strategies that are going to really open up this and bring real change, boycotts, really militant rejection and opposition to privatization. You know, we see in France right now with the transportation union fighting against the sort of privatization of pensions. What are the kinds of strategies that we need to really apply to make sure that we don't just continue to say no, and they march on as if we didn't matter or as if we didn't exist.
Well, Jokey Jehu of 50 Years is Enough Network and Olivier Houdeman of the Corporate Europe Observatory based in Amsterdam. I want to thank you both very much. The meeting of the World Trade Organization, which was raised throughout this summit, is taking place in Cancun, Mexico in September, and many people are preparing protests there. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. And if you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the